thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2022, and you are listening to episode 297, which is a conversation about the Apple TV Plus series Severance. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Joshua R. Ferris, who has a PhD in theology and religious studies. Dr. Ferris is also Humboldt Experienced Researcher at the University of Bochum, focusing on biologically engaged theological anthropology. Joshua's written an online exclusive television series review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called, "Why Are We Down Here Still Working in the Dark?" To read his review, you can do so for free if you're a subscriber to the Christian Research Journal at our website, equip.org. If you don't already subscribe and would like to read this review, please subscribe to our journal. And one of the perks for doing so is getting access to all of our exclusive online content. Joshua, it's good to have you on the podcast.
Hey, good to be with you, Melanie.
As I noted, Severance is a new television series from Apple TV Plus, and it's garnering glowing reviews from television critics, and so it's very well regarded. Severance is a thoughtful sci-fi adjacent series, I'd say, and last week it received several Emmy nominations, including one for Outstanding Drama and one for Adam Scott, who is an actor who plays Mark, who's one of the main characters in Severance. And Adam was nominated for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series. And it also received some other production type of nominations. But one of the interesting facts to me about Severance is that one of the executive producers is Ben Stiller, who is very well known for comedy. And as a matter of fact, the lead actor that I mentioned, Adam Scott, he's also known as a comedy actor, and this is a drama. And most recently, Adam Scott was known for the NBC series The Good Place as one of the demons. And we did cover The Good Place. So if you're a newer listener and missed that episode, look for Postmodern Realities episode 138. That was a while ago. And we covered The Good Place. But first of all, I'd like Joshua to give our listeners a bit of an overview of Severance. So what is the basic storyline of the series and what is the context that Severance is in? And tell us a little bit about some of the characters.
Good. Yeah, thank you, Melanie, and thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it. I loved this show. It is a rich show. And the basic premise is something like this. There's this corporation called Lumen Industries, and they have what's called the Severance, a medical operation. And this is philosophical or conceptual problem that kind of starts off the show. And so the medical procedure basically, somehow it separates your work life and memory from your non-work life or your personal and family life or home life. And so there's these employees that it focuses in on who have chosen to go through this medical procedure where they sever their sort of their perspectives, such that when they are working for Lumen Industries during the day, they cannot remember what they did at home. There is no memory. There is no recall. There's a complete disconnect or severance, as the show is called. And so the show really focuses on these individuals that have gone through this severance process. And they're called the innies and the outies. The outies are the ones who have chosen to go through this process. They've accepted it. They're the ones who are outies. They're called outies because they live on the outside world, the real world, outside of Lumen Corporation. The innies are those who are on the inside, who are living or working from day to day at Lumen Corporation in their little cubicles. So that's kind of the basic premise of the show. There are a few characters that the show really highlights, focuses on. Mark Scout, who is kind of the program head, he's sort of team leader over Dylan, who is Mark's coworker, and he's kind of the guy who enjoys all the company perks. You don't know much about him. There's not much about his history that the show tells. He seems to be sort of blissfully ignorant and doesn't care. He just cares about what are the perks. There's Helly Riggs, who becomes an important, you might say, co-sort of protagonist with Mark. She's a new employee who replaces an old employee who was attempting to reintegrate his innie and outie self. And so she takes a pretty pivotal role in the show as well. And then there are several other characters that we could talk about that are in the show. There's Irving, of course. He needs to be mentioned. Irving is another coworker of Mark's who's under his leadership and a part of the team. And he's kind of the stickler for company policy. He's the guy who really sticks to the book. And we all know those guys who, you know, we've probably worked with before. That's him. There's a lot that we could explore with all of these different characters and how they relate and what they bring to the show. But that's sort of the basic premise, the context of the show, and those are some of the main characters in the show.
Well, I will tell our listeners this, as they know, because we cover a lot of different films and television series, that this is going to be a very spoiler-filled conversation. So if the setup that Joshua has just given you sounds interesting to you, you might want to stop this podcast and come back to it after you've watched the series. But I will say the series is quite disorienting. The very first episode starts out kind of like in a company conference room, and that character that you mentioned, Helly R., is on a company table. She looks like she's passed out, and she comes to and wonders where she is, and she can't get out of this room. So it's a very kind of stressful situation that she's in. And you were mentioning the team leader, Mark, and they actually work for this department called the Micro Data Refinement Department. And it's kind of weird because their office situation is very cold and corporate, and they're the only people in the office, it seems like. It's just the empty hallways. It's just them. And they're trying to make quota doing these really odd puzzles. So it's a very, very eerie vibe that I get in this show. Like I said, it kind of has this quasi sci-fi adjacent kind of vibe to it. But really, when you were describing all this stuff where these characters have no knowledge of what they do on the outside and their outside characters have no knowledge of what happens to them at work, what do you think this series Severance is ultimately about exactly?
Yeah, I think you described it well. The kind of the setup in Lumen Corporation is what you might think of as all the sort of negative stereotypes of working in the corporate world. Sort of whitewashed walls. It's boring. There's no pictures. There's no reality. You're stuck in your cubicle all day. And so there's really kind of two big issues. One is the sort of the philosophical problem of, well, can this actually occur, severance? But I think the sort of the issue that is really focused upon is, as you said, this is kind of a sci-fi show, but it begins with a kind of utopian idea, as so many do, right? That there is this, you can sever your work life from your home life so that you can cut off the painful suffering that you experience in home, like so many of the characters. Mark, for example, one of the important facts about Mark is his wife apparently had passed away in a car accident. And so he decided this is part of the motivation for his making the decision to go through with the operation so that he could sever that part of his life while he's at work and he can focus on his work. And I think obviously Lumen Corporation has this in mind that they want complete allegiance at work. And so I think the sort of the big theme that is touched upon and that is explored in most of the shows in the series, this sort of hell-like experience. What starts us off as a utopia becomes very quickly a sort of dystopian nightmare. And so hell is actually in the name of one of the episodes. And there's a question about, well, how do I get out of here? So Helly, she's from the very beginning, she's trying to get out. She's kind of the rebellious one. She sees the problems. She sees the issues. This is not what it's cracked up to be. She wants to get out. And she can't seem to find a way out. So there are similar sort of themes that should point us back to this old play that was written by Jean-Paul Sartre called No Exit. And I think there's something like that is going on. That's where the sort of the discussion really centers around. A lot of the interesting themes and questions that are raised about, well, corporate life and the nature of hell and the fact that there is no exit. And it kind of, in many ways, it reflects this cultural sort of phenomena that we've experienced, I'm sure, and that we see. This idea of when we go to work, there is this sort of tendency to sort of compartmentalize our work life from our home life. That has all sorts of interesting consequences. The show kind of brings up and explores itself in a more extreme way. That's kind of the idea. That's what it's ultimately about.
As we near our 300th episode, and wow, I cannot believe it's been almost 300 episodes since this podcast debuted back in 2016, 6 years ago. And the reason why we started this podcast is so that we could give folks a taste of some of the content that we had both in our online exclusive articles as well as in our journal. And it's just been a really interesting process to talk to all of these journal authors who have such really thoughtful insights into cultural apologetics and theological issues. So I hope you're enjoying it as we bring you these various different guests and talk about all kinds of different articles and television shows and books and issues that we find ourselves wondering about as Christians, and to have an apologetic response to those from a Christian worldview. So we would ask that you would partner with us as we continue on past episode 300, and that would be the best way that you can help is simply to subscribe to our journal. That would really help, as well as get the word out about this podcast. Share episodes that are your favorites with a friend, or just put it on your social media accounts if you have that. You can email it to someone. But really, just word of mouth helps us out. And a lot of times people just stumble upon the podcast. They just discover it through just seeing some suggestions for them in their favorite podcast platform. But to help us be suggested even more to listeners out there who would be interested in our content, and I think that there would be a lot of people interested in our content, Christians wanting to be equipped with apologetic answers to some of the big cultural questions that we're asking or discussions that we're having right now, is to rate and review our podcast. The best place to do that, of course, is Apple Podcasts. And I'd like to see some new reviews. We have had the most recent review back in April. So it's been several months. And I know that there's thousands of you literally listening to this. We have 71 reviews. We'd love it for more, not just to pat ourselves in the back, really, but to help the algorithm to find this podcast and suggest it to other people. You can always subscribe to our journal at equip.org. And if a journal subscription is not in your budget, which is $33.50, which gets you the journal, that's the print edition, straight to your door. Now, print articles that we talk about on this podcast are not up on our website, although we have many thousands of previous articles up there, but they're not on our website for quite some time. You will get access, though, to all the online exclusive articles that you hear about on this podcast. But again, if it's not in your budget to subscribe right now, please consider giving us a tip. You know, the cost of maybe a coffee out or something small that you usually treat yourself to, we'd appreciate a tip for that, like $3, $5, $10. You can do that at our website, equip.org. Go there, see the tab that says magazine. Click on the drop-down menu, go to Postmodern Realities Podcast, and literally at the landing page of any one of the almost 300 episodes, you will scroll down and find a link to give us a tip. So thank you for partnering with us, for telling people about us, and also just for listening every week. We're grateful. Well, one of the themes, there are just so many themes here that you're right in the show that you were just mentioning, was the idea of work. And this is kind of fascinating, actually, and I sent a copy of this article to my son who works in Silicon Valley, but there was an op-ed in the New York Times back at the end of May, and the title of it is, "When Your Job Fills In for Your Faith, That's a Problem." And they talk about how basically a lot of the tech companies in Silicon Valley are trying to have your work life become your life. and everything about it. It's not just a 9-to-5 job there, but you have these really long work weeks. So everything is there. Your company is there. Your clubs are there. You do everything there. And you have this identity that's in your company. So I thought that was really fascinating as I watched this series, because that's like a real world question that was asked by this particular article. And that is true at huge Silicon Valley companies that have more than 20,000 employees. First of all your meals are free and they have clubs after work. And I mean, basically besides sleeping, you can be at work all the time. So that's kind of an issue I want to ask you about, because really, you know, in the Western world, it's kind of a first world focus for people. And that's our jobs and our profession and our pursuit of a career. I mean, from a very young age in, you know, middle school and high school, or even younger than that, people want to know, what do you want to do for a living? And so how should Christians view that? Because obviously, we're going to spend a majority of our lives at work. And you even talked about briefly that, you know, sometimes that's something that this show raises, the question, are you a different person at work completely than you are at home? And that kind of, you know, is food for thought for the Christian. I mean, why do we work? Is work a bad thing? You know, we're spending so much time there. You know, how do we navigate work well with a Christian worldview? Because, you know, who are we at work? And I think that's a big question for a lot of Christians now because of certain cultural things that are happening. I mean, I just had a conversation with a friend at church yesterday, and I said to him, well, you know, we use your company to get this product, but we're a little, you know, kind of troubled by some of the stuff that it's doing. And he said, well, that's every company. You can't get around that, you know? So how do Christians navigate different things that are happening culturally, and then who they are at work, and how should we even view work as a Christian?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a massive question. Yeah, so I think there is some footing that we can take when we look at the scriptures, and when we look at the tradition as it appropriates the scriptures in history. There, work is good. And I think we see that in early on in the creation story of the Old Testament, where God creates the world, and then we get to this sort of penultimate climax in the creation story, where he creates man and woman. And he gives this, what theologians call the creation mandate. And he calls husbands and wives, particularly, and we know that later on in Genesis 2, especially. He calls husbands and wives to do two things in particular in this creation mandate. One is to procreate and be fruitful, right? Be fruitful and multiply. And the other is to take dominion over the earth as image bearers of God. So from the very beginning, we have this placement of humanity in the garden that sets up, at least in some ways, a blueprint for how it is that we should think about and approach our work life. So work life becomes very important early on in Genesis. And I think this whole blueprint of the creation story is carried on and permeates the rest of the Old Testament story. And I don't think when we get to the New Testament, somehow we have this sort of church. We have such a church focus that it completely does away with or eschews the whole creation mandate that God originally gave to humanity in the garden. In fact, I think in many ways it's still presumed, and it's still part and parcel of what it means to be human beings. We are called to work, and work is a good thing. Work is a means by which we honor God with our hands, and it's a means by which we take dominion over the earth by being stewards of it, by serving it, and by building and constructing worlds and societies, but first constructing families. And I think so. I think that provides us a kind of framework for how we ought to think about work. So it is really, when we're talking about the question of identity, work, jobs, vocations are massively important to who we are and what it means to be. Well, what it means to be me? What do I do? Now, certainly in this sort of cultural climate of which this show is giving us some sort of lens into. There are excesses, there are extremes. I think we could point to all sorts of extremes where vocation becomes all-encompassing, such that your value almost solely is based upon what you do. Are you a medical doctor? That's a pretty high-ranking vocation. Are you a lawyer? I think also it's important to point out many of our identity problems, especially in the Western world, sort of the psychological identity problems that we experience, are wrapped up in our vocational lives. And so when someone experiences a sort of devastating end to their job, that is pretty shattering to people because, well, their whole identity is wrapped up in that vocation. So the show does prompt these sorts of questions. It prompts the questions of, to what extent should I be committed to my corporate life or my corporation? It's obvious in the show that the Lumen Corporation wants its employees to be totally undivided in their attention. And while they're there, they want to be, really, in one sense, a god to them. There's this whole sort of set of discussions and questions surrounding Lumen's sort of religious or spiritual environment that they create, where the creator of Lumen Industries is perceived as a kind of Christ-like figure almost. In fact, in one of the episodes, Irving, the one who's so committed to the sort of the handbook, he follows the handbook. He's a rule follower. And he's having this discussion. They're looking at the originator of the corporation. He's giving a kind of history with Mark present and with Helly especially. And he's trying to reinforce to Helly how important their work is, how vital it is to their lives. They're doing something really meaningful and purposeful. At the beginning of the conversation, Helly is looking at one of the originators, the female, and Irving is telling her about Helly, about this female and how impressive she was. And Helly was you could see she was kind of impressed a little bit, but she was saying, gosh, it makes me wish that I knew my history. It makes me wish I knew where I came from. It makes me wish I could remember. And so Irving responds in an interesting way and says, yeah, it's very unnatural for us to not have a sort of a history, a heritage. But he goes into this almost sentimental sort of lecture about, I felt this way too, but then I realized how important Lumen is. Lumen has done so much. Lumen is such a great company that has helped so many people, and it's helped people live successful lives by severing their outside life from their inside life in Lumen Corporation. And so he does all this for the purposes of giving Helly something to ground herself in, something purposeful. Because in that part of the show, Helly, you can tell, like, she's not buying it. She doesn't think that working for this corporation is meaningful at all. And in fact, at some point in the show, she goes to the extreme where she tries to take her own life because of how meaningless this work is. I say all that to say that there's a lot of questions that the show prompts that give us a sort of lens into the culture as it stands and how important work really is to us. And as you said, how important it is to us in the Western world, how it wraps our identity up in such a way that for many people, it is nearly all encompassing. So what they are is what they do at work. If they're a doctor or lawyer, that's what they are, and that's what their value is. And that's all they do. This, I think, certainly does lead to certain consequences that creates a kind of bifurcation that the show reflects, a bifurcation between their home life and their work life. So you could have, we know lots of examples in culture where we've had successful people in their work life, very successful, but they completely sever their lives from their home life. And they may not be good fathers or mothers. That part of life is kind of, you know, it's just, it's there, but it's certainly secondary to their work life. It's not the priority. In one way, that would be missing how it is that God has framed our vocations. In some ways, our vocations first are primarily to God, of course, but then to our family, to our children, and to society. Our work should be should function, at least in some ways, as following that priority, not to supersede it, not to engulf it to such an extent that you forget about your family or you forget about society. And so I think it's interesting in the show, I hadn't really thought about this, but their innies, they don't have any sort of wherewithal about a family. They don't know who their family is. And that's just not a focus. That's just not a priority, because their priority is to this Lumen Corporation. So there's a lot more we could explore in that. But I do think the way that God has framed the set of issues in the creation story is important for how it is that we think about and approach work. And some of the excesses or extremes that we find in the show really do mimic some of the things that we see going on in culture already, in the ways that we make an idol of our work rather than using our work as a way to serve both God, our family, and the rest of society. And so I think there's a kind of ordering that God gives to us in the Old Testament scriptures that are important for how it is that we should approach work.
Well, earlier in this podcast, you mentioned the play by Jean-Paul Sartre that's called No Exit. And I want to ask you about connections between that and Severance. I actually thought also of that play when I watched this, and I kind of would describe this show as really very winsome, apologetic for existentialism. And I do want to mention to our listeners that a few years ago, we did an article in our print journal that's now up for free on our website, equip.org, just talking about the resurgence of existentialism now. And particularly in this play, it talks about hell as people, really. And does Severance kind of mimic this particular line from No Exit by Sartre? And because I really, you know, when you think about the show, even when you go into the scenes where they don't remember what they did at work and now they're back home with their Audi self, all of the characters, well, the main character, I'd say Mark is the main character that you mentioned. He just has this very meaningless life. He's kind of struggling with alcoholism. He's just down and out since his wife died in a car accident. And then he has interactions very close to his sister, but he just kind of like doesn't really like his brother-in-law who's there, you know, part of his life. And so he lives in this nondescript house or apartment that's been subsidized by Lumen. So it just seems like every one of the characters that they're following, even the character that you mentioned, Irving, who is the real, just kind of almost has a religious fervor about Lumen Industries, in his Audi life, he just lives this solitary life that's just has no meaning. So there's very much this sense of dread at work, but yet a meaningless life outside. And so how does this, you know, idea of hell being people kind of characterize parts of this show?
Yeah, that's a big question. So I think that's an interesting dialectic that the show puts forward in a very sort of potent way. It is interesting that in both cases, their lives are just meaningless. Their lives begin in a kind of meaninglessness, or at least in a kind of pain that kind of, at least for Mark, kind of consumes him, which is the originating sort of motivation for him to go through with this severing operation. Going back to the No Exit, I think that is a helpful way of thinking about the show, because when it comes to the innies, there is really this sense that there are two sets of people that are making their life hell. One is the corporate leaders that are above them that are forcing them into this kind of servitude, or this kind of, you might even call it a kind of slavery, where they're working for Lumen. The other set of people are really, well, they're outies. Their outies have put them here in one sense. Their outies made the decision to sever them so that they have to live in this meaningless existence. And they're kind of, Ellie's really upset with her outie. Ironically, I mean, they're the same person. It does raise this interesting, weird kind of tension. How is it that the innie could be upset with the outie if they're the same self? But she is, and there's this particular scene where they have this exchange back and forth. The innie's upset with the outie for making this decision, and the innie Helly, tells outie Helly, I want to get out of here. And outie Helly records a video recording and responds back to the innie Helly and says, no, you can't. Your request is denied. And so there is this sort of like hell that's created between the innies, the Lumen Heads, as well as their own outies. They create the hell for them in one sense. But I think on a more profound level, if in fact these selves are truly a singular self, if Helly is Helly, both outie and innie, then in a more profound sense, the hell is not only other people, but hell is in us. And the show, I think, takes us some direction of sort of capturing that idea in this sort of second person way. We can kind of experience it through the characters. Hell is in them as well. And so it's interesting that you bring it up that way. The fact that they live this meaningless existence that Helly recognizes right off the bat, and then the other characters come along later in the show. But also in their home lives, they live a kind of dark, dreary, sort of depressed, meaningless existence. So it's interesting that both the internal and the external kind of manifest something similar. Hell is all around them. It's a pretty painful and depressing. Mark's whole life is depressing. It takes him a little while he's when he works as an innie in the for Lumen. It takes him a little while to come around to that conclusion. And at some point he does. He realizes, oh yeah. I mean, he comes around and he comes to a similar conclusion as Helly. But his whole life is meaningless. And interestingly, while they're at Lumen, there is no exit for them. But in one sense, at least while they're experiencing this life and they've chosen to sever, there's no exit for them there either.
You know, you mentioned the character of Helly R, and it seems like you were saying she has this dichotomy between her innie and her outie self. And they almost like despise one another. I mean, her innie is just kind of like a sweet, not very thoughtful person. And her outie is just really determined and very, I think, determined to get out of the situation. So what does this say about really the nature of identity? What are they trying to say, the creators, about this? Because can your identity, I mean, is it being denied when you're being severed for so long? Because these are two different, very, very dramatically different parts of her personality. And so identity is a really big issue in our culture right now. So I'm curious to know what you think that the series is trying to say about the nature of identity and who we really are.
This tension of identity, and when you go through this split operation, are you actually creating two selves? And so there's lots of articles in the blogosphere that are raising that question about in light of this show. Or is it, and this is something I talk about in the article, or is it something where they're sort of just split perceptions that are, and in many ways, don't overlap? And so they can live sort of these distinct paths of existence. But it does raise other questions about the nature of identity, particularly as you're talking about, when we think about contingent identities like work and how we tend to compartmentalize parts of our lives rather than seeking to integrate them in a way that our work life is somehow at least subservient to our home life, our family life. It does raise a question about that. There is a point in the show where Mark's brother-in-law sends him a gift, and it's a gift. He's an author. He's just written this self-help book. He's published it. He's really excited about it, and he gives it as a gift to Mark to read. The gift is intercepted by Miss Cobell. Miss Cobell is the boss in Lumen. She oversees the team. She oversees Mark. She's kind of this cold, calculated figure that is uncaring, not the motherly type that we long for. She's the cold, uncaring boss who doesn't really care about you. She cares that you get the job done, right? So somehow Miss Cobell has this unified perspective inside Lumen as well as outside. And she so happens to live next door to Mark. And so she's kind of keeping an eye on him, keeping tabs on him to make sure there's no way in which he finds out about what goes on the inside and vice versa. She's kind of a gatekeeper or something, you might say, to keep those worlds separate. And so she intercepts the book. It ends up at Lumen, and somehow the innies, while they're at Lumen, they find the book and they get really fascinated because they haven't read anything beyond the handbook, the sort of religious text of Lumen. And so they start reading this self-help book, which from their perspectives, they perceive as a gold mine of wisdom. So they start reading it, and there's a line in there that's important. It says something to the effect of, once you realize that you know, your job needs you more than you need it. And this sort of, the innies experience this sort of light bulb moment. And this is a kind of transition in this series where they all sort of are beginning to come together. They're beginning to be sort of united on the same page in their attempts to find an exit, to get out. Because they all realized, yeah, this is really meaningless. And so that moment, they realized that their identity is more than their work. Their identity is more than the existence of Lumen. There really is a world out there. At this point, they begin to realize that they've been in the dark a long time. And so now it's time to get out. And so Mark does raise this question, why are we still down here? Why are we down here still working in the dark? It kind of points us back to the sort of Platonic sort of allegory of the cave analogy, where we all know the story of the allegory of the cave, where they're in darkness and the idea is to have sort of this enlightenment, sort of revelational experience, where they come out into the light and they can see the real world, of which for Plato, philosophy is the means by which you arrive at the true light. And so there's this moment in there, and that sort of dialectic is at play as the innies are experiencing and raising the question about, what's the point of my existence and who am I really in relation to Lumen? And so they realize, I'm more than Lumen. There is something more to this life than my corporate existence.
I was going to say, one of the things that I found really fascinating about this when I was thinking about the series is they have this, I guess, as a reward, you were talking about earlier, how they have perks at the office. And one of the perks that they have is their particular department, the micro data refinement department. They all go on this field trip that the employee that you talked about, who does everything by the book, Irving, he's an older gentleman. He's probably in his 60s or maybe early 70s. And he takes them on this field trip to something called the Perpetuity Wing, which is a really creepy museum, I guess, in lauding the Lumen industry history, which actually goes back to 1866 is when this company is formed. And in it, it's almost kind of like a religious temple or a religious experience when they go to that. Don't you think that the episode kind of was pointing to that as, here's how work could be like a religion to you?
We see this initially in episode 3, where Irving makes this sort of statement. This may be one of the most sort of revelatory statements that he makes about his own character. He says, everything we do here is important. He starts going into this lecture about the place, and he talks about, at one point, I don't think I mentioned this, sees the statue, the originator, the creator of Lumen, and she exclaims, "Jesus." She says, "Jesus." And Irving corrects her and says, "No, Kier. Kier's the originator." And for Irving, he's like, this is where it's at. Kier is the savior of the world in the sense that he's the one who's come along and he's the one who's done all this good for humanity, including this sort of severance operation. So I think that's an important scene there where Irving is pointing us to the fact that Lumen is their religion. It is something, it is all encompassing, and that's where they find their meaning and purpose in life. And so then he goes on to expound upon the whole soul of Lumen as being a life and home for Heli and the others. Interestingly, we see that in the culture as well, where many corporations are describing work and their coworkers as family. So this is a common theme in many corporate jobs where they will talk about one another as family, which is kind of, I guess you might see it as kind of nice in one sense. They're trying to create sort of meaningful bonds between coworkers. But the fact of the matter is that corporate is not family. It's not what the Bible describes as being our central sort of identifying community. And it's even more than that, it's certainly not church. So the severance story really does pick up on this, and it picks up on this identity, religious identity question, the one in whom we find our identity. There's an interesting exchange between Mark and Irving in this conversation where they're discussing Kier as kind of this redemptive figure. And Irving lectures Mark on the meaning of life. And he goes on to actually rebuke Mark in a way because he's taking these things way too lightly. For Irving, it's like, this is all it's about. This is serious stuff here. Don't take this lightly. Heli is struggling. She needs to find meaning. And so he says she's, quote, starved for meaning. And this is supposed to satisfy her, this allegiance to Kier and to the Lumen community. But interestingly, Heli, as is consistent with her character, she sneaks out and she tries to get out of there. She sees it for what it is. This is no good. This is not meaningful. And so she tries to find an exit once again.
Well, how does this series ultimately help us think about Christianity? I mean, how can this series be a springboard for the Christian apologist to talk to viewers about spiritual things and you know, engage issues in our culture?
Yeah, I think so. One of the ways this really helps us think about Christianity or think about Christianity in relationship to culture is in some of the ways that we've described already, using this as a lens for for understanding the culture, using this as a second personal way in which we can experience the life of people in the culture and how it is that they are approaching their own work life and their own identity in relation to their work. Interestingly, when we think about it and when we look at the characters, there are these sort of signs of life that I think are sort of prompts for pointing us to God, or at least for reflecting more deeply on the inadequacies of our own work, the insufficiency of our work identity in and of itself. I think the show kind of illustrates that in a way by pointing us to something else that is out there, which at the end of, we start beginning to see that the Innies, maybe they found a way out into the outside world. There's still a question that I'm sure they're going to get to in the next season, but have they really found a way out? But they're certainly determined to get out because they realize there is something more. But whatever that more is, certainly isn't really resolved in the show. The show gives us pointers. It gives us signs that help us look outside of ourselves or look outside of our work life. But it doesn't resolve those questions. It's kind of like Platonic thinkers, the Cambridge Platonists, they talk about these golden threads in creation. These golden threads are kind of signs or pointers to God himself. And for many, they find the resolution in Christ, the one who truly reveals God. But there are these golden threads that we find throughout nature, God's creation, that are pointers or signs of the divine that point us beyond ourselves and beyond the creation itself to its creator. And so I think in many ways the show serves to, again, to give us a second person experience of people in their lives and how they're relating to their work life, their home life. And it helps us, or it provides prompts or ways of discussing with people the true meaning of life itself, and why, what it is that we truly want or long for deep down, which is found not in our work and not even ultimately in ourselves, but outside of ourselves. And so I think the show helps us to ask those kinds of questions because it illustrates so well not only the corruption, corporate life, and the corruption of our sort of compartmentalizing tendencies, but also just the inadequacies of work itself without a meaningful framework that points us to the Creator God and the Redeemer of that creation.
Well, whenever we review a series, I ask our reviewers, should Christians watch it? Because this is rated TVMA, which means for mature audiences. So could older teens watch it? Or what's your viewing recommendation for this series?
Yeah, good question. I think there's a few different ways to answer that. And I think one is, it is TVMA. I will say that it's rated MA, I think, primarily for language. And there's not for any other reason. I don't recall any other issues with the show in terms of not much violence. Certainly there's no sexual material or pornographic material in the show. I think the show is rated MA just primarily for the language. So yeah, I mean, when it comes to language, I take more of a looser view as an adult. I hear language all over the place in the real world when I interact with non-Christians. I think it's a pretty clean show otherwise that is well written. It's philosophically rich, and it provides a lot of food for thought as a Christian, as a thoughtful Christian who's trying to engage with the culture and trying to raise questions about our work life and how it is that we integrate our work lives and our home lives, how it is that we order our lives in a godly way that is honoring and virtuous. So I think there's much more to be gained than to be lost.
Well, I will just point out two things for maybe parents if they have some older teens that are going to watch it. By older teens, I mean, I would say, because it's rated R, 17 plus or 16 plus. And that would be, there is the obligatory LGBTQ queer storyline, but it is very, it is between senior citizens and it's not showing anything. So just be aware that that theme is in there and it's not central particularly to the story. And then the other thing is there is one really weird scene that doesn't show anything, but it is, there's no nudity involved, but there is some odd sexual, suggestions, but the scene is so brief that it doesn't amount to anything. I mean, it's seconds long, so
That's right. Yeah, they're both very suggestive.
Right. Yeah. So it's nothing overly overt, but if you are watching it together, it would make a lot of food for thought, actually, if you want to watch it with a teenager or a college student or something like that. So I'd suggest you watch it and talk about it. Well, finally, on a much lighter note, Joshua's a new writer for us, so I have some fun rapid-fire questions for him that we ask our authors so that our listeners and readers can get to know our authors better. So, Joshua, what's your favorite meal?
Indian food, curry.
Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Introvert or extrovert?
Bit of both. I would say introvert, more so.
And would you say you're highly organized or more spontaneous and go with the flow?
Highly organized.
Well, thank you, Joshua, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 297 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Joshua Ferris. He has written an online exclusive television series review for the journal. His review of Severance is called "Why Are We Down Here Still Working in the Dark?" And our subscribers can read this review for free at our website, equip.org. Now, if you don't already subscribe, you'll want to head on over to equip.org because you will want to subscribe for $33.50. And one of the benefits you receive is to get access to all of our online exclusive articles. So thanks for tuning in today to the Postmodern Realities podcast. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And it's in that podcast he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.